Hi, everyone. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. Today is June 22nd, 2021, and the interview that I'm about to broadcast is from a webinar that I ran last night, sponsored by One Israel Fund, with my very own nephew, who was the chief of staff for former Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and has a lot of insight on Israel's new government, some of the players, and what we can possibly expect. So enjoy, and thanks to Ben and to Tabitha for putting this all together, and I hope you enjoy the interview. One Israel Fund, for those of you not familiar with us, have been really the premier organization supporting the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria since the mid-90s. Playgrounds, sports centers, mother-child centers, synagogues, a lot of security and a lot of medical equipment. So for those of you who support us and support our projects, I just want to say thank you. And for those of us who have not yet partnered with us to make sure that the residents of Judea and Samaria have the same equipment and have the same standard of life as other people in Israel, we'd invite you to join us. We've been running these webinars now, well, really since the beginning of the pandemic, about once a month, have had some fabulous guests, Carolyn Glick, Sarah Atzni Cohen, Gil Hoffman from the journalistic side, Mark Zell, Avi Bell, and others from the political side, speaking about legal issues, speaking, of course, about politics. With the exception of one person, all the webinar guests live in Israel, because it's important to us that you hear the perspective of people who are really living the issues. And of course, one of our webinar guests a few months ago is now sitting in the Prime Minister's office. So don't minimize what we hear at One Israel Fund can do for you. But I'm really, really happy on a personal level to have on our webinar tonight as our guest, Ari Harrow, one of the few people in the world who knows how I spell my last name because he spells it the same, and my nephew. But aside from that, somebody who I have tremendous respect for. He was born in the United States, made Aliyah with his family when he was a boy, served in the elite Golani Brigade with Ari Fuld, if I may add, when he was friends, has an MA in political science from Tel Aviv University, was the national executive director of the New York-based Friends of the Likud in 2006, and in 2007 was appointed the foreign affairs advisor to Likud party chairman Benjamin Netanyahu. He then became Netanyahu's bureau chief in 2008 and continued in that role in the prime minister's office. After a stint in the private sector, he returned to the prime minister's office as chief of staff from 2014 to 2015, and he has for many years until this day counsels international leaders, governments, and businesses from across the globe. He's also successfully founded and launched a couple of companies, which maybe he'll have time to talk about. But the reason that I asked him to join us tonight is because he has a lot of information and knowledge of the players in the Israeli political system, how the system works or sometimes doesn't. And of course, from his time spent being as close as a person could possibly be to the prime minister, of course, has some insight. So Ari, I know you're in Florida right now, so you're in the time zone as most of my listeners. Thanks so much for joining us here for One Israel Fund.
It's really my pleasure, Eve. Thank you. And thank you to everyone who's joined us.
All right. So just to get this out of the way before anybody asks, there's a bunch of cases that have to be dealt with by the prime minister in the next few years. One of them you're involved with, and we'll see. Hopefully that'll go away. But we are not legally allowed to talk about that tonight. So if anybody had a question about that, you could save it for another time. Exactly. All right. And so we'll get on to the subject of, when I asked you a few weeks ago if you would do the webinar and I wrote up the title, I wasn't actually sure who the government was going to be. And so here we are, a week, 10 days into what looks like the most improbable kind of coalition you could possibly imagine running Israel's government. So, I mean, what do you think about what's happened here? And one of the questions that's already come in that was pre-sent in is, you think this can last?
So there's no question that this is one of the most challenging, if not the most challenging government that's ever been formed in Israel. There has been precedent to partners sitting on both sides of the aisle, people from the right, people from the left, but never before have we had an Arab party participate in that government.
Right.
And never have we had parties who identify with, let's call it the solid right, sitting with a party like Meretz. So there's definitely challenges that in this government's functionality. And it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I do think, though, that ultimately what brought this about was something that we've seen over the last few years, and that was the inability of the Netanyahu-led right-wing bloc in forming any alternative. And ultimately, when Naftali Bennett had to make a decision, which was a complicated decision, I'm sure we'll talk about it, whether to head towards a fifth election or try to make this work, he obviously went with this decision, which put him in the prime minister's office.
Right. And I mean, the reactions to that here in Israel, and I'm sure it's trickled out of the country as well, have been really astounding from people like myself, I'll say, who are cautiously optimistic that things can work here, to people who have, there's no other word other than flipped out completely and feel very betrayed, which is understandable. It is for people on the right, and I'm going to imagine that most of our listeners tonight here do find themselves in the national camp or pro-Judean Samaria, and concerned about the fact that in the government now, for the first time in many, many years, are people who, if you didn't even get them, like, you know, in a one-on-one, who would be very happy to stand up and say, we want to dismantle the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, the new minister, I don't know how that works gender-wise, of transportation has already said that she wants to stop the funding for the roads that are being built out here. So how do you think that Bennett, whom really comes from the right, and many would say he's further to the right than Bibi. He was the head of the Yesha Council for many years, and definitely his positions, his public positions have always been consistently pro Judea and Samaria and the communities here. How do you think he's going to be able to handle that kind of pull coming from inside his own government?
I think it's going to be a difficult challenge. I think that, you know, when analyzing the situation, you really have to separate to a certain degree, the ideology or the ideological pull from the political pull. Not that one is more important than the other or less important than the other. It's just the reality that every prime minister is faced with, and he's going to have to find that balance. You know, I was thinking about it the other day. If you look back historically on right-wing prime ministers, the first right-wing prime minister came to power in 1977, Menachem Begin. And the first thing he goes and does, and he ran on a very consistent right-wing agenda for many, many years, including, you know, the necessity of establishing a Jewish presence in Judea and Samaria and all of Israel. And the first thing he does is reach out to the Egyptians and sign a peace treaty where he withdraws from the Sinai. Then you follow up with Yitzhak Shamir, who ultimately, you know, quote unquote, caved to U.S. pressure and went to the Madrid talks, opened up the door to talks with the Palestinians, followed by Arik Sharon, the great champion of settlement and involved in the foundation of the One Israel Fund, right? Who ends up turning his back on the settlements by dismantling Gush Katif and some settlements in the Shomron, and so on and so forth. So the precedent for a right-wing politician coming in and facing political challenges that may pull him to the left is not new to us. And I think that in a sort of weird way, Bennett's position of having a smaller party versus having a larger party actually handcuffs him in a greater way from taking any drastic moves like that.
Really?
I think that, you know, when Arik Sharon was sitting on, you know, a large party, or Menachem Begin, et cetera, but they had an easier time to take steps that, you know, that appeased, let's call it the other camp or the international community. Bennett's going to have a much more difficult time because of the very narrow political base that he's sitting on. So I think that although, you know, there's concern with any government, and definitely a government that has an Arab party as a member that is affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, a left-wing party like Meretz that is very clear in their position on Yehuda v'Shomron and on many other topics. You mentioned Mirav Michaeli, the head of labor,
right,
who's also made her positions very clear. So there's no question that his balancing act is going to be very, very difficult. But I do think that as he looks at that balance between politics and ideology, his maneuverability is going to be much less than some of his predecessors on the right.
Mm-hmm. So that should make us feel better.
You know what?
We're looking to feel better here, Ari. Yeah.
Prophecy was lost many, yes, many years ago. So it's hard to tell. I mean, one thing I will tell you, for all the grief that Bennett has gotten on the right, I remember a story that I participated in when Netanyahu was the head of the opposition at the time, only had 12 seats in the Knesset, going back to 2008. And if you recall, Prime Minister Olmert resigned from office. Tzipi Livni was temporarily given the position, and she had a very narrow window of a few weeks to try and establish her own government and take over. And I was sitting with Netanyahu in the Knesset cafeteria, and his political advisor, who happens to be Shalom Shlomo, who today is the one pulling the strings behind Bennett's rise to power, came over to us and said that Tzipi Livni is going to an election. What was the background to it, again, if you recall, was Shas had demanded an additional 800 million shekel to join her government. And she decided that it would make sense politically to go to an election on principle, saying, I didn't give in to the Haredim. So she had agreed to give 400 million, but was not gonna give them one shekel more. And Shas ultimately decided, okay, we're not joining the government. That led to an election. When Prime Minister Netanyahu heard that she chose an election, he started laughing hysterically. We literally sat there for 20 minutes just laughing in the Knesset cafeteria. And the reason being, and he said it very clearly when he could finally catch his breath.
Control himself, yeah.
Exactly. Was that the public's attention span is extremely short-lived. And if she would have given them an additional 400 million shekel, which in the scheme of things, if you look at the, you know, the vast Israeli budget, et cetera, is a drop in the
mm-hmm. ocean,
she would have taken over the premiership, and she would have been attacked for a day or two, or maybe a week, and that would have been it, and she would have been prime minister. And that was a very important lesson that I learned at that point from the prime minister. And it's a lesson that I know is a fact that Naftali Bennett knows and that Shalom Shlomo shared with Naftali Bennett. He saw an opportunity to prevent Israel from going to a fifth election.
Right.
He saw an opportunity to come in and to take over the premiership, even if it is with a very, very narrow base. He saw an opportunity to try and implement policies that he feels very strong about. And he also believes, and, you know, according to Netanyahu, rightfully so, that in a month from now, no one's even going to remember the political reality.
Mm-hmm. You know, you bring up Shas. This is also the first time, maybe ever, but certainly in my memory, that you don't have Haredim in the government. And as a result, and I was at a wedding, actually of a supporter of one Israel Fund, Joe Grove, Mazel Tov again, on Dana's wedding, and speaking to somebody whom I was sitting with, who's a lawyer, who's very involved in the rabbinate and in choosing the rabbis and for different political positions here in Israel. And he was telling me that there's a very interesting situation brewing now with Matan Kahana from Yamina, who is a Kippah Sruga, a modern Orthodox person or national religion, as we call it here in Israel. There's a chance here, perhaps, for some kind of religious reform, something that a lot of Israelis feel that we need some changes when it comes to kashrut and conversions and local rabbis perhaps making some decisions instead of the big political machine that has been built by the Haredim. Do you think that they're going to stay? They're very far from the plate right now. And also there's a committee that's been established to investigate what happened in Meron, which a lot of the Haredi politicians did not want to have happen for reasons that will probably become clear as the commission does its work. Do you think that they're at some point going to come into this government because it's just going to be too difficult for them to stay out, or they won't be able to if they want to because of Lieberman, whose plank is about as anti-Haredi as you could possibly imagine?
Right. So I think, firstly, just to correct you, there have been a couple of governments without the Haredim in it. Netanyahu joined up with Lapid. That was actually the first time that the Bennett-Lapid, what they call in in Hebrew, Brit Achim,
the brother coalition
came together. Right. And that actually kept the Haredim out of that government. And interestingly enough, Bennett paid a very heavy price for that agreement with Lapid way back when. And he spent the years after that trying to repair his personal relationship with the Haredi community. So he sort of took, a number of steps back with the creation of this new government.
Right.
I think that the issue of religion and state is going to be one of the main issues that come to the forefront in this government. You know, when we get on a platform like this with the One Israel Fund, everybody's immediate concern goes to Yehuda Ve'Shomron. And I don't know if that is going to be the focus. Not to mention the fact that, the Palestinian issue has really not been an issue of public debate in Israel for a number of years now. I'm not saying that it won't come back, but it's definitely not a pressing issue that we see in the Israeli public today. Whereas religion and state is definitely at the forefront.
Yes.
You mentioned Lieberman. Lieberman is one of only of three parties in this coalition. Add Yair Lapid to it, and add Meretz to it. There are three significant parties in this coalition who have very, very, very solid, very staunch opinions of what needs to be reformed within the relationship between religious and state. Some of which is anti-Haredi, some of it is acceptable to, let's say, that the modern Orthodox, the Dati Lumi community, but not everything. And I think that Bennett, getting back to the balancing act that he's going to have to master, he is going to have to not only keep those partners in check by giving them some victories. Everybody within this coalition is going to need to have certain victories to take home to their constituents. But at the same time, he is going to have an eye to the future. He's going to want to have the opportunity, whether it's in this government or in a future government, to try and repair his relationships with the Haredim. And he can't do that if he goes all out in the opposite direction. Keep in mind that Naftali Bennett, as every politician in a parliamentary system, ultimately they're thinking about their future. And he wants to be prime minister, not for the 2 years that are allotted to him in this agreement. He wants to be prime minister for a lot longer than that. And for him to think a couple steps ahead, and he's definitely a strategic thinker, he can't burn those bridges with the Haredim completely.
You mentioned him being a strategic thinker. There's some noise from somewhere. You mentioned him being a strategic thinker, and that comes out really, I mean, I know him personally, but also it comes out really in almost every interview, even when someone is, you can tell, doesn't like him in the interview, that definitely comes out. And it's interesting because he's not the only prime minister to come out of the elite unit, Sayeret Matkal. Right, Bibi's also, Ehud Barak also. Is there something in your experience, also you yourself served in an elite unit. Is there something in that particular unit or in the army in general that is either geared to this kind of person or creates this kind of thinking while they're doing that service?
There's no question. By the way, you mentioned earlier the now minister, Matan Kahana. He also came out of that same unit. There's others as well. If I'm not mistaken, maybe Yoaz Hendel also served, if not in that unit, another one of the elite units. I think there's a combination of things. Firstly, on a more broad, in a broad sense, there is a drive that is that you're taught in these units that these leaders definitely had. You will not outwork Netanyahu, and you will not outwork Naftali Bennett. People ask me in the years that I worked with Netanyahu, that must have been really difficult, a tough person to work with. And my answer always was no. He's actually not a tough person to work with. He was very pleasant to work with. He was not someone who got angry or upset, but he worked around the clock. If you weren't ready to work, you know, 20-hour days, then you were in the wrong place. And Naftali Bennett works the same way, and so do some of these other former commandos. The other thing that I think is very important when you think about the way that the thought process of these leaders is you're trained and you're taught in Sayeret Matkal to never make a decision until you have to. You always want to leave options open because reality changes. I think if you look back at the Netanyahu years, you'll see that many times. You know, he sort of dodged around issues and dodged around people. He had the Obama years and the this and the that. And that was his way of keeping his options open and while moving the ship forward. You know, obviously his focus always was the Iran issue. So he was willing to sacrifice a little here, sacrifice a little there in order to, you know, to reach what is the ultimate goal from his perspective. I assume that you're going to see very similar behavior with Naftali Bennett. Naftali has been very successful in it. You know, we talk about the fact that he's prime minister with only 6 seats. How many seats did he have when he became defense minister not too long ago?
Right.
That is probably also it's unprecedented in the history of Israel. Somebody sitting on such a small party, all important defense ministry. So I think that is the type of behavior that all of these people have in common. Ehud Barak was very similar in the way he handled his staff and the premiership. And I think that's what we'll continue to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting insight. So you mentioned Iran, which of course I think will continue to be the big issue going into the Bennett administration and coming up though against, I mean, I hate to say against, but it looks that way against a Biden administration. Where do you see this going?
It's going to be very interesting. Again, if I go back to the divide between ideology and politics, even though this is a policy issue, politics is going to play into this, and it always does. I don't want to minimize the Netanyahu years, but it definitely, from a political perspective, was very convenient, right? It's very helpful to say we have this existential threat. So, for example, when the Obama administration came down with a demand to freeze building in the settlements in Yehuda Shomron, the reasoning that the Netanyahu administration, and you know, I was in his circles at that time, the reasoning that was given and was conveyed to the heads of Yehuda Shomron was, this is existential, we need to deal with this, and we need the Americans on board for certain things that are taking place. So that's a policy decision, it's a security decision, but there's a very significant political element to it as well. And I think that as Naftali Bennett enters the fray here, in his opening cabinet meeting, which took place this past Sunday, the one policy issue that he raised was Iran and the appointment of a new leader there. The Israeli security organizations are 100% unified in their assessment of Iran and the, you know, significance and the seriousness of the threat that comes from the Iranian nuclear program. Having said that, he's going to have to deal with that on the one hand while trying to keep the relationships with the United States in a different place, in a better place. He does not have the, I guess let's call it the gravitas that Netanyahu had, whether it's in Congress or in the US media. And that will be a disadvantage to him. And when they look at his coalition back home, and they know that there's a lot of support for taking a different approach on Iran, he's gonna have a very difficult challenge on his hands.
Mm-hmm. Look, one of the things happening here in Israel that the people who are now in the opposition, meaning the Likud and Smotrich and others, have spent. They're not being gracious losers, let's put it that way. And there's a lot of talk about how this government is not legitimate. And I personally think that's very damaging to Israel on the world stage. I mean, this is, you're not happy and you think that something was stolen from you or this didn't come about the way that you think it should have come about, or that politicians said certain things and then went back on them. But there's a bigger picture here of a world stage of other countries looking at Israel and like on an issue such as Iran, where we're going to need people on our side, whether Israel does something or doesn't do something, it can be quite damaging. I mean, when you were involved, did you like see behaviors like this where you thought to yourself, I understand you from your own personal point of view, but there's a country here and an image of a country here. It can't just be about your own agenda. I'm sure you've had experiences like this, being so close to some of these people.
For sure. And I think that the person who was harmed by that more than anyone, it was Netanyahu. People questioning his legitimacy, people questioning his beliefs. And I completely agree with you. I think that it is legitimate to be unhappy with this government. It is legitimate to question Naftali Bennett's decision to go against some of his election day promises. But I don't think it's in the interest of the state of Israel for us to question the legitimacy of this government. I think that, you know, rules are very clear. There are, 61 hands need to go up to form a government. Even if there's a minority government, you need to have, you need to have that support. And this government has that support. I think that the opposition's goal is to bring down this government, and that's what they're going to do. But bringing into question the legitimacy doesn't serve anyone, not in the short term nor in the long term.
Yeah, I was listening to one of the radio shows this morning, very popular, Arya Golan. He's on every morning. And Ophir Akunis, who's you know very well, in the Likud, was railing about this. And Arya Golan said to him, listen, you're going to have a soldier listening to you say this, who's maybe going to have to go into battle, or the prime minister is going to call for something and he's going to, you know, he's going to have to join. Feeling like, well, maybe I don't have to listen because it's not a legitimate prime minister. He said, you can't do this. The country has to feel like this is the government now. We may not be happy with it, either from the right or the left. But it's got its say. This is a democracy in a sea of non-democracies. You mentioned Iran. And of course, Assad won 97% of the vote a few weeks ago. So we know what we're dealing with here in this part of the world. And it's really, really important that and I'm not so sure people in the world understand that Israel really stands alone in its freedoms and in its values. It is a Western country in the Middle East in that sense. And we have to be very, very careful not to undermine it. But you mentioned the opposition doing what oppositions have to do. So there's an interesting law that's now being kicked around, this reunification law, which is an old law, or it comes up every year and it's just kind of automatically renewed, but now they want to set it in stone. So I'm sure people have heard about this. Maybe you can explain to us exactly what this is all about, because this is going to be the opposition's kind of first attempt to make a stand on, being an opposition.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Well, they've already succeeded in making it an issue, which speaks to the frailty of this coalition. I mean, there is no question that when week one, an issue of this magnitude comes up and brings the coalition into question, then you obviously have a very rough road ahead. I won't get into the to great specifics or great details about the law, but in essence, it's really like the law of return for the Arabs. It allows for Palestinian Arabs, whether it's through family reunification, marriages, et cetera, to, for lack of a better term, let's call it, emigrate into, the
Israel proper.
Right, into proper.
Yeah, little Israel. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And it's, it's a loophole in the law that allows them to shift the demographics of Israel. It's obviously a significant issue. It's an issue that has been dealt with by law, but as you mentioned, it's a law that needs to be reapproved on a regular basis. And it just shows the gaps within this coalition, because the coalition does not have the majority to pass this law. And if they don't, it would be a tremendous blow to Israel's security. It would be a tremendous blow to the demographic situation in Israel. And it's really brought the questionability of this coalition to the forefront.
So one of the things that's being broached now is a law, I think it's by Simcha Reutemann from Bezalel Smotrich's party, that would make it a real law. like not just renewed every year, but actually they're saying it would be even better because it would finally put this baby to bed.
Right.
So is that how they're trying to get off this tree?
Yeah. No, I think that, you know, this is the push and pull that we're going to see for as long as this government lasts. So the Likud and the opposition and the right wing of the opposition opposes this law. Now, ideologically, they voted in favor of this for many, many years.
Right.
Obviously, that's not the issue. The issue is, number one, they're trying to highlight the fact that this is, using the terminology we were just talking about, this is an illegitimate coalition. This mm-hmm. is something that is not sustainable. So therefore, you guys wanted to party with, you know, with Rahm and with Meretz, then good luck to you. And at the same time, Simcha Rotman's suggested piece of legislation is let's call it a more right-wing version of the law
right.
that does solidify it long-term, and it's being brought from the opposition. So now now they face two choices, the current coalition. Number one, how do we pass the law as it is? And assuming we can't, do we support the opposition's law, right? So is Naftali Bennett and his party, is Gideon Saar and his party, is Avigdor Lieberman and his party going to line up behind a more right-wing version of this law, which solidifies it for the long term, which is in everybody's ideological interest? So we'll see in the very near future whether politics works out or policy.
But, I mean, look, aside from their pride, I suppose you could say, is there a downside to them doing that? Does it give the opposition more strength, or does it maybe show that we can work together? That whoever's sitting, as you said, on either side of the aisle, when it comes to certain elements and certain laws that they see eye to eye on, which is going to be many, they can work together.
That sounds nice.
You know me, I'm the happy aunt. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. This is definitely a power play. And if the opposition puts this forward and the coalition or part of the coalition ends up supporting it and thereby passing their law,
mm-hmm.
You basically had a situation, right? Reverse it for a second. Opposition does have the opportunity to pass this with the right wing of the current government. So it will be the opposition that is dictating terms, that is dictating legislation, and will be a very slippery slope for the coalition if they go along with it. If they don't go along with it, then the big losers on both sides are going to be the people of Israel.
Because right, exactly.
This gaping hole is going to be there, and we're the ones who are going to suffer.
Mm-hmm. I think these are the kinds of games, if you will, that we're going to be seeing here for a while. Look, a major issue that a lot of Israelis, I think, felt some kind of relief that at least we had some government, whether they liked it or not, is because there have been many things that haven't been done in the last 2 years that needed to be done. And the biggest one, of course, is the budget. So can you explain to us why it was so critical that a budget be passed? We haven't had a budget, I believe, in more than 2 years.
Correct.
So what does that exactly mean? I mean, we're spending money, the kids are going to school, the buses right. are running. So what does it mean that we didn't have a budget?
The way it works in Israel is that if the budget is not passed, then you automatically just continue at the pace of the last budget that was passed. So the last budget existing government ministries, existing projects continue to get funding. But number one, the funding is at the same rate as it was 2 years ago.
Three years ago, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, COVID is not a great example, but let's give it as an example, right? So the budget for the Ministry of Health in Israel continued to be the same budget that it was pre-COVID. I say COVID's not a good example because they passed a special
right.
vote to add funding to the ministry specifically around COVID. But, the same is true with education or security or anything else. So that is a significant issue. The second significant issue is new things that come up that don't fall under the realm of the existing infrastructure, right? Whether it's a new government office, whether it's new issues that the country suddenly faces, et cetera, those are things that you cannot have taken into account when the budget initially was created.
Mm-hmm.
So it's of utmost importance for them to pass a new budget that takes in the fiscal responsibilities of the government, not only today, but of the coming year and a half.
Mm-hmm. And will that, you think that there'll be some agreement, like that's less ideological? I know there are obviously some ideological components. Like I mentioned, you know, where are you going to build roads? You're going to put the money on for roads in Yudava Shamran or in the Galilee. Right. And obviously there's choices that these ministers make based on their own personal preference. But in general, is there more or less agreement? Let's say, like you mentioned COVID and you mentioned the health system. And I just heard yesterday, Zev Rothstein, the head of Hadassah Hospital, saying that the hospitals were so close to collapse, we can't even imagine. They weren't doing so well before COVID. We have a tremendous shortage of beds and shortage of medical personnel. That has to be taken care of immediately. But that shouldn't be a right-left issue. No? Like that's
I agree. I'm just laughing because I remember, back in the day when I was involved, when I was working in the prime minister's office, every time we got to the budget, it seemed like the entire country was about to collapse, right? I mean, the education system was about to collapse, right. The healthcare system, security. I mean, the generals would show up and say, we were on the verge of war, not on four fronts, but on 18 fronts, right? And we had to increase everybody's budget. And that's just, that's part of the political games that take place. Having said that, there are many elements that are, let's call it non-controversial, non-political. Obviously, if you're a minister of health, you want to increase your budget as greatly as possible, and you want to increase your capabilities. And the same is true for every other ministry. But there are ideological pockets within the budget. And I think that we're going to see them from both sides. These are the ways for politicians to go back to their constituencies and say, hey, look what I did for you. So you talked about the roads in Yudava Shamron. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Bennett's party or Gideon Saar's party pull a few nuggets out of the budget so that they can wave them to,
the right wing. Placate, right.
Right. And say, look, we've delivered for you. You're worried about this government. You don't have to be worried. But the same is going to be true
to the left.
On the left side, whether it's Meretz or Labor. And I'm not even talking about the Arab party, because their party is actually very interesting. And this is really going to be one of the, I think, most interesting and most historic turn of events that come out of this government. We shouldn't forget that the Likud and Netanyahu were trying very, very hard to bring Ram into a right-wing government just a few weeks
ago. Yes, they were.
Now, from a right-wing or a Yudava Shomron perspective, how is that possible? And ultimately, the story that they were promoting, which now Bennett is promoting himself, right, is that this isn't about Yudav Shamron. This is about dealing with significant domestic issues that face the Arab community in Israel. Now, it doesn't matter how right or how left you are, dealing with some of those issues are of utmost importance to us. Let's talk about the violence within the Arab community.
Right.
That is something that every so often spills out into the Jewish population. I won't even touch on the riots that we saw a few weeks ago, because that definitely had an ideological flavor to it.
But they had the guns.
Right. And they have this ongoing, there's a sense of war within these communities, and no one, and under 12 years of Likud leadership, nobody dealt with this. And one of the issues that Ram, purports to be representing is the need to rein this in. The same is true with their educational system and their healthcare, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So are they going to use their access to new funding and to government to really improve Israeli society to the point where maybe they are, and I'm talking about obviously the Arabs living within Israel, to the point where they're less antagonistic, where they're less hateful towards the Jewish state, or are we going to be funding activities that are going to further strengthen and cement the type of radical ideology that does exist over there as well? So these are some of the things that we'll get a sense of once the budget is brought to the forefront.
Mm-hmm. These are major concerns that Israelis have. I think for many years, myself included, we were looking at integrating Israeli Arabs as a good thing. We all work with Arabs, shop with Arabs, whatever it is, see them on a daily basis. And it was seen as look, they might never stand up and sing Hatikvah at the top of their lungs, but they'll appreciate Israel. They'll understand that they have more chances, not just the women, but, you know, they just have more ability to get ahead living in Israel than they do in some of the surrounding countries. And what you mentioned, and the riots and the lynches of a few weeks ago while we were having the Hamas kerfluffle or war, or whatever it ends up being called from Gaza, I think shook up a lot of Israelis. Exactly what you're saying right now. Are we just funding people who ultimately are fifth column and want to undermine the state? I mean, perhaps as some kind of confidence building gesture, and maybe this applies to the Haredi community as well. There could be some kind of laws put into place that everybody does national service. Obviously, not everybody can do the army for a million reasons. Not everybody's even physically fit enough or mentally stable enough to do the army. It's a tough place to be. But that every citizen in this country, no matter what their religion is or their no religion or level of religion, has to do something for the country. Have you heard any? Has that ever come up really in a serious way in the years that you were in government also, or was just too much of a hot potato?
No, I think that was, you know, that is the potential that exists here. It also could be the great downfall that exists here. It was not something that was seriously discussed in the years that I spent in government. Every so often, there was a flare-up with a specific issue, whether it was a road that Israel was building that skirted an Arab neighborhood and it would lead to, you know, protests and violence, or
right,
whatever, and how to deal with them. There's been, you know, the Bedouin issue down south, which has been a serious issue, and the fact that they've created an autonomous zone within
right,
Israel proper, that Israeli security forces, Israeli bureaucracy does not enter. It's a very dangerous situation. And as you're saying, this has not been dealt with in the past. And it has to be dealt with one way or another, meaning the rule of law has to be implemented. It's in Israel's interest, regardless of what happens amongst the leadership of the Arabs, to start implementing rule of law. We will benefit from it more than anyone else. But ultimately, is there an opportunity to go beyond that? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that's popped up on the chat is regarding the Iran party's influence. What do you think will occur with the illegal Bedouin settlements in the Negev? That's also been one of the issues. Like in Yehuda Shomron, you can't even, and I'm not exaggerating, you can't close in your porch without the defense minister signing the piece of paper.
Yeah.
But in the Negev, which is, again, Israel proper, Israeli law, you have, I don't know who, if, you know, our watch, our viewers have been down to the Negev recently. Everywhere you look, there's a little Bedouin settlement on every little hilltop, and they're going to want to legalize them. That has the potential really of bringing down this government.
For sure.
Like, where do you think, who's going to handle that?
Well, bringing down the governments is something else, which I'm happy to talk about right after this comment, because I think that, you know, it's going to be a lot more challenging than people believe. But I agree with you. I think that these are the type of issues, less so, again, whether or not we're building a new settlement in Yehuda Shomron, and more issues like this, because what's happened, you know, for the last couple of decades is that governments of Israel have turned a blind eye to it because they just don't want the headache of implementing the visuals, as you can imagine, of going in and dismantling homes and taking down illegal structures, which, by the way, is never an issue when it's Jewish homes
in
Yehuda Shomron, but it becomes an issue when it's Arabs in the Negev. Are images that are going to be very difficult to sell to both sides of the current government, right? The ones on the right obviously have spoken out very, very publicly for the last few years. Naftali Bennett, Avigdor Lieberman,
etc.
They've been at the forefront of calling for dealing with this issue. But at the same time, and I believe within the coalition agreement with Ram, there is a section that deals with this issue. And if I'm not mistaken, it at best, it kicked it down the road. It definitely does not deal with it. If anything, it may actually feed into the issue, but they're definitely, it's not going to be an issue that this government deals with, which will just make the situation that much worse.
It sounds like we're going to be keeping a lot of status quos in place in order to keep this government in place. Exactly. Not doing too much in Yehuda Shomron, not doing too much in the Negev. I mean, trying to take positive steps that most people would agree with, but you know, exactly. I don't think we're putting a synagogue on the Temple Mount anytime soon either.
Exactly. I mean, there's going to be little stuff here and there so that everybody could go back to their, you know, political base and say, see, we've done something. But they're going to, you know, the ability to stay away from controversial issues in Israel is extremely limited. Everything is a controversial issue. So, you know, there is some work to be done, but these issues are going to hit them in the face. This, by the way, I just want to touch for a second on, you know, the comment you made before about the government coming down or bringing the government down. It's going to be very difficult to bring the government down. For a number of reasons. One reason is that the way it works today is that in order to bring this government down, you need a vote of no confidence. With 61 hands going up on the other side around one candidate, meaning you have to suggest an alternative candidate in order to get 61 people to replace the current government. That would mean that Netanyahu, even if he has his block, which is now numbered, I think, at 53, he would need...
That's the Likud, the Haredim, and Smotrich, more or less?
Yeah, and the one deserter from Bennett's party.
Right. He really won 7, but yeah, okay. Right, Shikli.
Right. Yeah. So there are another 8 votes that you need to side with that block in order to replace this government. So this isn't, you know, about, I don't know, Ayelet Shaked or Idit Silman having, about what their conscience and saying, you know, I can't do this anymore and moving over. You're going to need not one party. You're going to need 1.5 or 2 parties, right? Even if Bennett's entire party says, you know what,
we're done.
Right, we're done. We're moving back to the right. You still cannot bring down this government. You would still need an additional 3 votes to get. Mm-hmm. So the chances of that happening, of you finding 8 people from the current government that are willing to come over to the other side, and it's not just coming to the other side. Is the Likud at that point going to replace Netanyahu, or is it going to be Netanyahu?
Right.
So
Yuli Edelstein's already making moves. I mean, you hear voices on the Likud who are unhappy with Netanyahu.
Nir Barkat, a few others. So the chances of that happening politically are not very great. The other thing is that if you look at the current political standing of each of the parties that have joined this coalition, none of them are in great shape, or I shouldn't say none of them, but most of them are not in great shape. Bennett is not in great shape politically if he goes to an election today. Either is Gideon Sar, either is Ram on the other side of it. So they have an interest in keeping this together as long as possible. And Bennett wants to be prime minister as long as possible. So he wants this to go the full 2 years. So I think that you're going to see compromises that under normal circumstances, people may not have been willing to make just to keep it together. Before you see the government come down, it's not.
Well, and that I think hits on people's fear when it comes to Bennett. And you gave us a long list of right-wing leaders who did the exact opposite once they got into office for whatever reason. Is that, for example, one of the questions, you know, we had Naomi Linder Khan on from Regavim talking about the rampant illegal building in Area C funded by the EU to the tune of a lot of money. And so one of the questions is, will anything be done about the illegal air building in Area C? Will Israel stand up to the EU, which is funding a lot of this building? And from what you're saying, Israel's going to try not to tussle with the EU as much as possible. So they're going to keep building.
Well, that is actually one of the issues that did come up in the coalition agreements. If I'm not mistaken, it was Gideon Sar's party that put that front and center as part of their demands joining this government. And there's actually, let's call it an ongoing tussle between Gideon Sar's party and Benny Gantz's party over responsibility for overseeing the implementation of changes in Area C. So there is a desire in this case to deal with that issue. Whether or not it gets lost in the bureaucracy and amongst the political games going on, you know, remains to be seen. But I do believe that because Gideon Sar and Tikva Chadasha made that one of their flagship issues, the chances of something happening are greater. You know, Gideon Sar actually taught me a lesson years ago. He was the chair of the opposition when Netanyahu was in the opposition. And he became a minister when Netanyahu first became prime minister in 2009, but he was still responsible for much of the coalition's doings. And one of the things he taught me is that in the Israeli system, where there are supposed to be elections every four and a half years, you really have basically 2 years to get things done. Because the second you hit the middle mark, the second you hit halftime, everybody's looking ahead to elections and everybody's worrying about their own constituency. So the chances of pushing significant decisions through become mm-hmm. much, much harder. So having said that, I think that some of these issues, like the issue of Area C, I believe will take place over the coming year, because he's going to want to go back to his constituents and say, look, I succeeded in doing something. So mm-hmm. I think that there is a chance that we take that issue on.
But what you just said about the 2 years on, 2 years off, you could say about the United States elections as well, you know, that they start campaigning once they're ready 2 years in.
But
it's not unique to Israel.
The system is definitely less advantageous in Israel, meaning the United States, from that perspective, although they do start campaigning, 2 years into their term. And I would argue, having run campaigns around the world, Obama actually changed that because he never dismantled his political infrastructure after his first election. And he had them running all the way through his first term. And Trump did the same thing with his team. But there is a level of stability in the United States where you know you're there for 4 years. Israel, once you hit that middle mark, and that's why, if you look back over the last 30 years or so, the average length of government in Israel is less than 3 years. Because once you hit that point, everybody automatically scrambles back to their political bases and starts playing to the home crowd.
Right. So Ken Abramowitz had a question here that I just lost. I have to go up and get this. I think it was about the Supreme Court and the basic laws. Because you have an Arab party now in the government that is against some of the basic law in Israel, can the Supreme Court intervene here and strike this government down? Sorry, Ken, if I didn't do you justice here. That was more or less the question.
Well, first of all, warm regards to Ken. Mm-hmm. It's always great to see him and to communicate with him. That is asking, that's a very tall task to expect that of the Supreme Court. Not because they, let's just say I can't see them choosing to intercede in such matters when they've had the opportunity to do so in the past on things from the other side. They've obviously shown where their hearts and minds are. I'm trying to be careful with what I say here, but I would not expect any type of insurance coming out of the Supreme Court to protect us of, to protect basic laws when it comes to Rahm or any other Arab parties.
Maybe I'll give a physiological answer. The heart is on the left side of the body. So maybe that kind of throws that in there. What we haven't talked about, of course, is Gaza. Not just what we had going on a month ago, but we have had fires. I don't know if people are aware, which is terrorism on every single level. This is also the harvest season. There's a lot of things growing. If you've been down to the area around Gaza, those are kibbutzim, those are moshavim. Part of the communities that really helped set the borders of the state in the 1940s. And their produce is literally going up in smoke in addition to the health issues and everything else that it causes. What we had over the last decade was kind of a double standard when it came to the people around Gaza, mortar here and there, fire here and there. Sometimes it was even more than that. And the people in that area feeling like they're second class citizens. And just that nobody cares. You know, when rockets are falling down in Tel Aviv, everybody gets all bent out of shape. But around Gaza, that's just the way it is. And they've been living like that for 15, 16 years. Do you think that based on what he's done just in the last couple of days in response to some of what's coming out of Gaza, you think Bennett's going to change that paradigm?
I hope so.
Also from his stint as defense minister and what
right.
he was thinking.
So, you know, I think that there's, firstly, I'll just recall the first day that Netanyahu entered the prime minister's office. I believe it was April 2nd, 2009. And I was sitting with him in his office alone, and the military secretary walked in and said that they just shot whatever it was, you know, mortars or missile out of Gaza. And Netanyahu turned to him and said, I'm going to tell you this once so that you don't have to come in and update me on every time something is sent over the fence. Every single time they shoot at us, we are going to respond. And he did. We sent planes up in the air and we responded. And they tried doing this. They tested Netanyahu for a day, for 2 days, for a week. And when they saw that he meant business, it slowed down. And it slowed down for a number of years until they, gained confidence again. Right. I think that Bennett starting off his term this way is strategic. I think it's very important, and I think that he's done a good job with that. He's made it very clear that we are not going to allow you to slide back into, what they call, drizzle from Gaza.
Drizzle.
That is not going to happen. I think that the big question is going to be, you know, a few months down the road and a year down the road. It's one thing to establish yourself as a force to be reckoned with. It's another thing to sustain that for the long term. And as important as that is, and this touches on what you just raised before, what is the strategic long-term solution to this issue? Is there a strategic long-term solution to this issue? Because we can respond, and maybe we buy quiet for a week or for a month, but then it starts up again. And, you know, parallel to Israel taking a hard stance over the last few days, I saw that Israel did release certain goods into
right.
the Palestinian into Gaza and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So we're already starting to loosen the strings a little bit. And I think that this is an issue that since the disengagement has never been dealt with on a strategic level. And I think that it's about time that it does. Now, this may or may not be an opportunity for a new government. You know, something that happens to a government that's been in place for 12 years, and that is that your thinking is more or less the same throughout. You know, it's hard to think out of the box, as you've seen this before, you've done this before. When new people come in with new views and new approaches, maybe there's new ways to go about dealing with this issue. And the Gaza issue is an issue that has to be dealt with in a better fashion. I'll just say that I think on the Hasbara front also, I think that our handling of this last conflict in Gaza from a Hasbara perspective was just horrendous. And I think that a lot of that is a lack of ingenuity. It's a lack of thinking differently, and there are ways and there's terminology and there is means to convey a very different message, which would allow us to play on a more level playing field.
Mm-hmm. Is there anyone you can think of who is an expert in that? Like we don't have, because it sounds kind of like Soviet Union, like a minister of information, right? But there have been articles and there have been a lot of discussion about the need to really have professionals. I mean, not just the guy from Dover Tzahal, as sweet as they are, they're standing in their uniform. They don't look so user-friendly. I mean, I love soldiers, but I understand that when you're speaking in front of a so-called progressive world of TikTok and whatever's going on, that's not really the image that's going to make Israel look sympathetic and look like we're not really killing little children indiscriminately.
Right.
So, I mean, what would you suggest? Also, as somebody who's really counseled a lot of people. And, you know, and I just have to say that I remember when your hair was flaming red. So I can just tell our audience what these years of public service have done to you and for you. But like, if you were given the reins, you know, if you were said, all right, we're going to take your advice on this. How do you think Israel, because that's a constant complaint that our PR is terrible.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, firstly, there is a position within the Prime Minister's office called the Director of Communications or the Director of Hasbara. And that person, unfortunately, is in charge of both domestic PR and international. And, you know, what's the biggest knock against Israeli high-tech companies? When you deal with them within the professional world, it's not the ingenuity of their technology. It's their ability to convey
the
that
market,
through,
yeah.
Right. And we have the exact same problem when it comes to our national Hasbara. And that problem is, you know, if you're Coca-Cola and you decide to open up a factory in Nigeria and sell to the locals, are you going to use your American PR firm to sell it in Nigeria? Or are you going to find a local firm that understands the lingo, that understands the culture, that understands messaging, and use them? And I think that that is the biggest failure that we have, is that we're not looking at our viewers or at our audience and trying to understand them. We're trying to get them to understand us. And that is a huge Hasbara error. You need to speak to them in a language that they understand, in a way that they'll understand, and in terminology that they can relate to, as opposed to trying to convince them that we're right because of A, B, C, or D. So I think that ultimately is one of the things that needs to be changed. I think that we have to have native speakers, native
right.
experts that can relate to whatever audience it is that we're talking to.
Well, and we have, because of the kibbutz galuyot, because of the ingathering of the exiles, we probably have people living in this country from 120 different places speaking every language on the planet, more or less, who can do that, who can be a resource here, who understand Israel and can be a resource to whatever it is where they came from in order to get that message out. But maybe it's not something the government should take on. You know, maybe this is something that should be something from the private sector, just like with Israeli high tech. You know, it's the private sector that is one that doesn't have those limitations and doesn't need to be reelected. They can get things done. That would be incredible if during this administration something like that came up. And I mean, I hope that Bennett sees the importance of that as well, even if we're doing the right things and the people think we're not. So at the end of the day,
right.
We see the results. We see the anti-Israel results. Yeah, so somebody said, and 100%, Mark Karoff, that the PR failure is not just Israel's. A lot of it is people are just waiting out there for us to do anything wrong and skew things. And then, of course, we have a newspaper that's written very well here in Israel that puts out things that are just anti-Israel, and there's no other way of putting it, because we have a free press. So we have a free press.
Yes.
So they can say what they want, even though some of these things just cause people to hate Israel because of how vile they are. So it's a problem when you're a free society. It really is.
It is a problem.
Our neighbors have it much easier.
Right, that's for sure. But you know what? I think that within that free society, you see the division on other issues as well. Obviously, the tremendous divide in the United States and in the US media between the Republicans and the Democrats, between the pro-Trump
right.
and anti-Trump, or pro-Biden and anti-Biden, that exists.
Yeah.
And it's really a question of how you deal with that. I don't think that you're gonna wipe out age-old anti-Semitism just by improving our terminology. But I
right.
do think that amongst those that are open-minded to hearing what's really going on, we can do a better job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely think so. Anything you can tell us that, like a behind the scenes thing that you can share with us? I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I remember talking to you when Netanyahu made his famous speech, what was it, in June of 2010? What was it, about
yeah.
a two-state?
Yeah.
You weren't the happiest person I'd ever spoken to that day. But is there anything else you've been on meetings where you were the only other person in the room except for the king and I, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Is it Is it really an impossible situation to be the prime minister of Israel? Is it in your opinion, is it possibly the most difficult job on the planet?
I'm convinced that it's the most difficult job on the planet. There's no question about it. The job of president of the United States, for example, is obviously much broader. Your global influence,
superpower,
is much
right.
greater. You don't deal with the day-to-day physical threat to the existence of your country. You don't face the type of other challenges, whether it's global anti-Semitism, et cetera, that the state of Israel faces on a day-to-day basis. And there's not a day in the prime minister's office that you're not facing a crisis. And because of that, and it goes back to a point you made earlier, even if someone or even if we don't agree with everything about this government, I think that, in the interest of the Jewish people in the state of Israel, you have to pull for the leadership. It's something that we need, because he is going to face tremendous challenges. It's funny, you mentioned Ofir Akunis before. So when I first joined Netanyahu's office, he was the head of the opposition. He's back in the same job he was.
I don't think you should expect a phone call, though. But okay, you've got other things going on.
Even though I will say, when I left the prime minister's office the first time, I said to some of my colleagues, I said, everybody leaves the prime minister's office. It's just a question of when and how. That's what it comes down to. But I'm getting back to Akunis because our staff at the time, when I first joined Netanyahu's staff, the chief of staff to Netanyahu was Naftali Bennett. The bureau chief was Ayala Shaked.
Right.
Communication advisor was Ofir Akunis. And the political advisor was Shalom Shlomo. So it was a very interesting group. And I received a picture from one of those individuals a couple days ago of the group of them sitting around after Bennett was sworn in as prime minister. So I think it is important to remember, Ma'ayin bata ulanata olech. Ma'ayin bata, these are people who did come, from a good home. They came from the Likud. They came from, from Yesha. By the way, speaking about home, and I don't want to divert too far, but when my parents decided to make Aliyah in the early 80s, they came on a pilot trip to Israel. I think it was 1983 or 84. We made Aliyah in 1985, and as part of the program, they spent Shabbat in Haifa, and were put up at different homes. And my parents happened to be put up at the home of Jim and Myrna Bennett.
Really? Wow. Naftali's parents.
Naftali's parents. And they spent Shabbos with him. They had a relationship. And I believe still today. But when I met Naftali for the first time walking into Netanyahu's office, our families had a long history before them. So I know where they come from.
Right.
I think that we can all feel good about that. As far as where they're going, I think that having reservations is good and natural, and it will keep them honest. But I do believe that giving them the benefit of the doubt, that they will stay true to their ideology, to supporting Yehuda v'Shomron, to doing what's right on so many different issues. It's in all of our interests.
Tiferet Medinat Yisrael. Okay, it's an amazing, incredible country that we live in, and God willing, we will have the leadership that we need in order to get us through. We're doing really, and I want to say that, many kudos to former Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu for really doing some incredible things during his years as Prime Minister and bringing us to some really special points, not just getting us out of COVID, but peace treaties and things like that. And hopefully the next Prime Minister or the current Prime Minister will also make his mark in a positive way, and Israel will just continue to flourish and be the great place that it is, and with potential for more. Okay, thanks to everybody who joined us tonight for your questions And of course, thanks to One Israel Fund for sponsoring these webinars. Of course, no cost to all of you so that we can educate you a little bit about Israel. I will keep trying to find interesting and knowledgeable people to join us and to ask questions of. And Ari, thank you. I really appreciate your wisdom and your experience. And I know there's a lot there that you cannot talk about and won't talk about. And, I admire your loyalty. I appreciate your loyalty to the people that you have worked for. And I know that there's a lot of things that you did that made this country a better place as well. And we will just leave it at that. And maybe one day the elevator for Ma'arat HaMachpelah that you were pushing for all these years will finally go up so that people who want to go pray in one of our holiest sites don't just have to climb the stairs. I know that was a pet project of yours. And I hope that one day happens. Okay, Ari Harrow, former chief of staff and all that to Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and many other things. And once again, go to our website, One Israel Fund, see our projects, watch our virtual tours. About once a month, we put out a tour of a place and people. We did a fabulous one, Sadnat Shiluv, about a wonderful village for kids with special needs in Gush Etzion. Lots of projects that we have to be involved with because this whole thing isn't just up to the politicians. It's up to every single one of us. And if we feel that there's going to be a gap here in the next couple of years between the needs of Yehuda Shomron and possibly what the government can provide, then we just have to roll up our sleeves and get in there and do even more than we've been doing before. All right. It's an opportunity for all of us to make a difference. And that is a really big thing. So thanks very much again, also to Shauna for running things behind the scenes, Eve Harrow, Director of Community Development and Tourism for One Israel Fund. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye for now.
My name is Jeremy Gimpel, and I live here in the mountains of Judea. And in these unprecedented times, I wanted to offer you a gift from the Land of Israel. We've been here at the cutting edge of the Jewish return to the Land of Israel. We've come to the place where King David first assembled his men and where he wrote most of the Book of Psalms. We are quite literally transforming this desert mountain area into a Garden of Eden-like oasis. Watching prophecy manifest into reality, we felt called to reach out to the nations to teach them lessons from the Bible in the original Hebrew, unlocking insights and understandings that you can only get if you read the text in its original language and from a Judean perspective. The prophet Zechariah spoke of a time that 10 men from all the nations will grab hold of the corner of a garment of a Judean man and say, "Take us with you, for we have heard that God is with you." Perhaps this is the time that the righteous among the nations will now make a sharp U-turn and reconnect to Israel, reconnect to Judea, reconnect to the Hebrew roots of the spiritual realities of this world. This is an invitation to join us at our next live gathering with hundreds of families from over 30 countries around the world. And if you register now, we'll give you a free gift from Israel, the first 5 sessions that unlock the secrets of the Hebrew Bible and how to live as a believer in these times. I hope to see you at the Land of Israel Fellowship. Shalom.